This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Today on Masters in Business, I am pleased and thrilled to bring you Jeff Sout, Chief Strategist of Raymond James. You know, I'm always thrilled when I bring in these big name guests to sit and talk with in a format that they normally don't have access to. When you see guys like David Rosenberg or Laszlo Borini or Jeff Sout, it's usually you're catching a few snippets of them on financial TV where it's 30 seconds and they're off to a commercial. This format really gives us an opportunity to do a deep dive with somebody and get into their history, their background, how their philosophy came about. And I've known Jeff Sout for, I want to say, over a decade, maybe a little longer than that. Both professionally and personally, I've been to his home in Florida. I've spent time with him in the woods of Vail, Colorado, drinking wine and engaging in deep debate. And he is really a fascinating, fascinating guy. What I really like about him is his entire approach is very much driven by experience and data and not by the usual assumptions. His track record over the years has been very, very good. He's unusual in that a guy on the sell side, meaning a broker-dealer side, those are your big firms like Raymond James or Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley, he's been fairly nimble. He's been willing to reverse himself when the data suggests that's what's needed. And he's not afraid to say, okay, you could take a little something off the table here. You don't usually get that from the big houses. They tend to be either all bulls or all bears. He falls in between. I've been reading him. He puts out a weekly commentary that's available on the Raymond James website and has been doing so for, I want to say, more than 10 years, maybe more than 15 years. It's always interesting. It's always insightful. It gives you a perspective that you may not find anywhere else. I find him to be just a really intriguing, really fascinating guy. And I think you will, too. Be sure to stick around after the broadcast portion of the show to check out the podcast extras, or you can just fast forward and get right to that. It's really worth your time. He's a fascinating guy, and I think this is a really interesting conversation. Without any further ado, here's Jeff Sout, Chief Market Strategist at Raymond James.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, I am thrilled to bring an old friend onto the show. You may know him from his many appearances on TV and radio. His name is Jeff Sout, and he is the Chief Investment Strategist at Raymond James. Jeff, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back here at the Bloomberg Studios.
So Jeff and I know each other, I want to say about 10 years or so from around the street from
Minionville.
Minionville.
We first met at Minionville out
right.
At Vail, Colorado for
that's
Minions
right.
In the Mountains.
That's right. I recall
with your lovely wife.
That you were very, very astute memory. That's excellent. I recall drinking a lot of wine in that event.
Copious amounts.
Copious amounts. Horseback riding, shooting, and just it was generally a fun thing. And for those of you who don't know, Minionville is the website run by Todd Harrison, who is probably best known. I call Todd the original financial blogger. He was writing for Jim Cramer's Street.com website. He was writing the trading diary back in like 97.
Yeah, that's when he was also running the trading desk at Cramer and Berkowitz.
That's
Jeff
right.
Berkowitz and Jim Cramer's outfit.
That's right. And so when he was doing the daily trading diary, here's what I'm buying, here's what I'm selling, here's what I'm looking at, that effectively was the first financial blog. He very begrudgingly accepts that title. So someone came out and called me the grandfather of financial blogs, but I was reading Todd online 5 years before I was formally blogging. So I would really give him credit not only for introducing the two of us, but really for being the first blogger. So Let's talk a little bit about your career. You've been on the street for 40 years.
43.
You began, now I know of you back in the E.F. Hutton days.
Yeah, that's
but
correct.
I don't know if that was your first gig on.
No, I started up here in New York on Whitehall Street for $100 a week.
Right.
And have held most of the jobs that you can hold in this business.
So how did you end up at E.F. Hutton, which was a pretty big brand name back in the day?
Well, I got moved to Atlanta, Georgia in 1972. I started up here in January 71, and the trade desk manager quit in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was the only one in the organization up here that had a Southern accent.
Right.
So they asked me if I would go to Atlanta, Georgia, and I said, sure. And so my wife and I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and we were actually making markets and options. This is before the CBOE.
Right.
And we were trading stocks. I had a $100,000 box and six stocks that I traded for over-the-counter trading.
Why did the Southern accent make a difference sending you to Atlanta? They just didn't think Northerners would do well there?
Have you ever been to Atlanta?
I have.
They all have Southern accents.
Yeah, okay.
So we got down there in the summer of 72, and most of our money was coming from making markets and options, not really trading stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the CBOE came out in April of 1973, and I had taken my wife to Chicago and was thinking about buying a seat on the CBOE for $10,000 back then.
Would have been a good investment.
Would have been a great investment. But she took one step out in Chicago weather in January and said, honey, I'm not moving here.
Brutal. Chicago's so winters. Just
we
brutal.
Went back. We went back to, especially this winter, it's been exceptionally brutal.
As was ours. Ours was horrific up here. Listen, I've lived in New York for half a century. I can't ever recall this many, forget teens, single digits, zero. I don't ever recall zero before this year. So this is this polar vortex, whatever you want to call it. It was just a mess. We have family in Chicago. I've been going to Chicago for Thanksgiving for 30 years. And the joke was, we complain when it's, you know, in the 20s, and they're like, 20s? Double digits? What are you complaining about? They get single digits or negative.
Oh, they got negative
basis.
25, 26, 27 degrees, yeah.
Yep, yep.
And a lot of that has to do not so much with global warming, but with, if you go Google it, you'll find out there's more volcanic ash in the atmosphere than in the recorded history of the planet. It started with that volcano that erupted and shut down Heathrow.
A couple of years ago,
yeah.
Right.
And there's one next to that called Grimsvolten that's been erupting ever since. There's just a big one that just hit in Indonesia about 6 weeks ago. And what that's done, it's caused the Hadley cell winds to shift closer to the poles, move towards the poles. Now, the Hadley cell winds north of the equator spin counterclockwise. South of the equator, they spin clockwise, and they carry the hot equatorial air up into the troposphere,
right,
where it moves towards the poles. Normally, 30 degrees north, 30 degrees south. With all the volcanic ash in the atmosphere, they've shifted, and they've shifted dramatically.
You have a very broad set of interests. We've talked about this previously. So in addition to beautiful sunsets that you get from volcanic ash, it definitely has an impact on the weather. But I want to talk a little bit about how you ended up as a strategist from making markets. How did you make that transition?
My wife wouldn't move to Chicago for the CBOE's debut. And so I went back to Atlanta, Georgia,
mm-hmm,
and figured that the option business was going to be dead once the CBOE opened.
Right.
So I got a job as a regional options coordinator with E.F. Hutton and started running a retail book of business. I penned my first strategy report in December of 1974 at the absolute nominal low of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It was on December 6th, and the Dow was at 577.60 on,
wow,
a closing basis. And I have been writing strategy pretty much ever since. In conjunction with that, I have been an analyst, a portfolio manager, director of research at four firms, and the head of capital markets at two firms.
So in the last minute we have left for the segment, you've pretty much seen Wall Street and investing from just about every major role. And now you're at a shop that's considered a very large company. Raymond James manages how much money these days?
A little over $400 billion.
That's some real, coming up on $500 billion. That's some real wood. We're speaking with Jeff Sout, Chief Market Strategist for Raymond James. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about combining technicals with fundamentals, and how to use the long cycle of markets to facilitate your investing.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz, and I'm sitting here with my friend Jeff Sout, who is the Chief Investment Strategist at Raymond James, which manages about $400 billion. So let's talk a little bit about your methodology, your process. I've been reading you for, it seems like, a decade or longer, and I know that you're not specifically easy to type. You don't have a declared major. So you believe a lot of the same things I do, so my confirmation bias is going to come out. So not only do you look at the world through the visage of cycles, but you also believe that fundamentals and technicals equally play a role in viewing the investment landscape. Is that a fair assessment?
That was more my dad that drilled that into my head. My dad was a money manager, and he always used to say, you know, fundamentals and technical, son, it's like words and music. And I can remember him when I was a young kid sitting at his desk on Saturday posting up his logarithmic charts with colored pencils. And I asked him one day why he did it in colored pencils. And he said, because you can't Xerox color.
There you go. That makes a lot of sense. Back then, you couldn't Xerox color.
Correct.
The way I had heard that, the way I had learned that version of sound and music, lyrics and music, was fundamentals tell you what to buy, technicals tell you when to buy it.
Exactly.
And so I'm always astonished that guys who claim not to use technicals, I'll ask them about a stock, and the first thing they'll do is punch up a chart. Hey, what are you doing? You're a fundamental guy. You don't look at technicals.
Yeah, I tell my analysts the same thing that poo-poo the charts. I say 99% of the PMs, portfolio managers, you go in and start telling a story. What's the first thing they do?
Pull up a chart. They're closet technicians.
Well, that's the world they live in. When you can be measured to the second decimal point every morning, it becomes a pretty humbling business.
To say the very least. So who were your big influences? Who helped you form your investing worldview?
My father had a lot to do with it. He actually trained me as a fundamental analyst. He made me read The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham when I was 13, and I've probably read it a dozen times since then.
13. That's a childhood cruelty, I think.
That's a little young. I agree with that. I didn't do that with our son, who is also in the business, by the way. And it's just over the years, it's like being a sailboat in the water in St. Petersburg, Florida. The longer you're in it, the more barnacles you develop on your hull.
Right.
And you learn all these, if you're open to it,
you learn.
Yeah, all these different things. And in business school, they try and make this business real complicated. And you do have to understand the language of accounting, which is the language of this business. But when was the first time you noticed that the only store in the mall that was always packed was the Apple store? For me, it was 2003. Apple was single digits.
Right.
Or the first time you
pre-split.
Yeah, the first time you saw the Keurig one cup coffee machine. To me, it was in 2008. Stock was single digits.
I recall getting my hands on one of the first iPods, literally one of the first iPods, and saying, oh, Sony Walkman for the digital era. This stock could go to $20 or $30. And by the way, being told Apple at $30, you're crazy.
Yeah.
In New York City, it's funny you mentioned going to the Apple store. I want to say it was around 05, 04, somewhere in that period, you would step onto the subway and everybody had the white earbuds. Like if you hadn't seen it coming in 02, 03, by 05, 06, and the stock was still had a ton of room to go, the white earbuds suddenly were, it was like a vine growing everywhere. All you had to do was pay attention.
It's exactly right. 2 years ago, if you paid attention to what the younger crowd was doing, they were puking up their iPhones and they were buying the Samsung Galaxy 4.
That's right.
And you would have had a really nice pair trade, short Apple, long Samsung. You would have made money on both sides.
That's right. I'm talking with Jeff Sout of Raymond James, and we're discussing what influenced his worldview, his market view. Aside from your dad, who else were major mentors in your career?
Well, up here, when I first got in the business, there was a trading firm called Mayer & Schweitzer, and it was Lenny Mayer and Herbie Schweitzer.
MASH, of course.
Yeah, and that was their symbol.
Right.
And they had a big influence on me. There were some people along the way in Atlanta that mentored me. And then when I moved back to Richmond, Virginia to work for Thompson McKinnon and then Wheat First Securities, I was back with my dad. But a lot of it has come from talking to people like you. and other portfolio managers. I mean, my real value add is that I talk to people that have to put money to work.
Right.
And so I was an analyst long enough and a portfolio manager long enough that if the story makes sense to me, I can pull the numbers up on FactSet, and in 10 minutes I can decide if I want to start buying the stock or not, if the technicals confirm it.
When you were at Weed First, did you overlap with Don Hayes?
I did overlap with Don Hayes. He was the chief market strategist back then. I was the options strategist, and I ran four different departments, the retail block trading desk, the options strategy department, the options department, the option execution. Yes.
You would be hard-pressed to find somebody who was writer during the 90s and made the turn in 2000 to get defensive than Don Hayes was. There was a decade-long period, call it 93 to 2003, where he was money good. He was just so unbelievably solid.
Yeah, he's been very successful, too. I called on his son. He wasn't in the office in Nashville when I was there seeing accounts, but his son works as a portfolio manager there, and they've done real well in the asset management business, too.
Right. I think he kind of went a little off the rails after 9/11 and didn't see 08 coming, but God, in the 90s and the early 2000s, there were, and talk about influential, the Don Hayes concept of the three, and this goes back to fundamentals and technicals, the market as a four-legged stool with one leg being generally the up long-term upward trend, and I think if memory serves, it's valuations, market internals, and interest rates were his three legs. But I could tell you, I know he influenced a lot of people over a long time. So let's talk a little bit about fundamentals and technicals. You look at the market today, and some people are screaming that markets are extremely expensive. I think they're a little pricey, but not crazy. And you look at this long-term trend from March 09, 5 years later, that's a pretty solid trend line we've seen. How do you see both fundamentals and technicals here now?
I think that you are in a new secular bull market, very similar to what you lived through from 1982 to 2000. The problem with a lot of people in our business is that they've only been in the business 15 years, so their shared experience is you buy a stock, it goes up 30%, you sell it and look to do it again with another stock. They haven't understood, or experienced, is better put, the advantages of, and really compounding wealth of, holding high caliber blue chip dividend paying stocks from 1982 to 2000.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jeff Sout, chief market strategist at Raymond James, where we discuss the comparison between cyclical versus secular markets.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. Today I'm thrilled to be here with Raymond James' Jeff Sout. He's the chief investment strategist for the firm, and they're running about $400 billion. We were talking about some of the technicals that you use in conjunction with fundamentals. When we discuss fundamentals, we're typically talking about valuation, but within the broad concept of valuation, we see pretty substantial swings in markets, and you're one of the few people I know who pretty consistently writes about buying or selling stampedes. Explain what a stampede is.
It's something I picked up over the years. Once the momentum gets going, a stampede, either on the upside or the downside, tends to last 17 to 25 sessions, with only 1 to 3 session counter trend. In the case of a buying stampede, it would be a pullback. In case of a selling stampede, it would be a throwback rally until they exhaust themselves. It just seems to be the rhythm of the thing, in that it takes somewhere between 17 and 25 sessions before people get either bullish enough to throw in the towel and buy stocks, which puts in a short to intermediate term top, or bearish enough to throw in the towel and sell and make a short to intermediate term bottom. It's just something I've observed. There have been some that have run 25 to 30 sessions, but it is pretty rare to have one run more than 30 sessions.
So given the silicon that's moved into the market, given how much is being traded either by algorithms or by computers, or people have been talking about Michael Lewis's book, flash boys, how much high-frequency trading is impacting. How do you see that impacting the way markets operate?
Well, you did get last year the longest buying stampede I have chronicled in my notes of over 50 years, and I'd have to go back and look to give you the exact number of sessions, but I think it was in the 60 to 65 session skein. On the upside. The next longest one that is chronicled in my notes was the 38-day upside buying stampede that ended up peaking in August and led to the 87 crash.
Oh, really? Very interesting. Yeah. So we had a 60-day move and 60-something-day move.
Never got a crash.
And all we saw was a 6% pullback in January. In fact, we had referenced that we've gone more than 400 days without a 10% correction. Somebody told me that from 90 to 97, you went a really long period of time without any sort of a 10% correction.
Yeah, I was writing coming into this year that the history, if you go back and study it, of rallies like we've seen from the June of 2012 lows without a 10% or better pullback, is that you're due for something like a 5 to 7% drawdown in the first 3 months of the new year. And sometime this year, if past is prelude, you're due for a 10 to 12% pullback. But I think you have to view those within the construct of a secular bull market.
So we're going to spend a little more time a little later talking about secular versus cyclical. So let's hold off on that. But stay with me on the stampede. So when we're talking about a buying stampede, obviously you're indirectly referencing animal spirits, sentiment, psychology. How important is that to your process?
That's very important. A very wise man once said, in the long term, the stock market is a weighing machine, but in the short term, it's a beauty contest. And in the short to intermediate term, the stock market is fear, hope, and greed only loosely connected to the business cycle. I used to teach a college course, and I only did it for one quarter because I got in arguments with the finance professors who say nobody can outperform, so you might as well index and forget about it. Well, that's just patently untrue. I can name hundreds of people that have consistently outperformed. And if markets were rational, which is what they teach you in business school,
right,
Citigroup wouldn't have traded at a buck. Not rational. At the inflection points, markets are anything but rational.
That's exactly right. The fascinating part about, take a guy like Bill Miller, who beat the market for 15 consecutive years. When you run that regression analysis, statistically, you end up with one in a trillion. It just couldn't be random. It's not just a tiny percentage. It's an outrageously impossible percentage for that to have happened. You would have had to run 100,000 managers trading for a billion years to end up with that sort of streak. And the fact that he did that, or Buffett's long-term track record, or go down the list of the top performing hedge fund managers, I've always found it so unsatisfying when the efficient market types say, well, they're just random. Somebody has to be the outlier across the bell curve.
Yeah, look at Tudor Capital. His record, he was in the 30-plus percent forever until they broke it up. He and his partner broke it up. I forget how many years ago that was now. But I can sit here and show you a bunch of investors that have outperformed.
Dalio, 23% a year for 38 years. Jim Simons, 30% a year for 40 years. You know, whenever somebody puts up a great track record and says to their outside investors, here, take your money back. We're just going to save this for our own money. You know they're not fooling around. They're really, really serious.
Correct.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jeff Sout, chief strategist for the $400 billion in assets under management, Raymond James. And we continue our conversation discussing where we are in this long-term secular market.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. I'm talking with Jeff Sout. He works for Raymond James as their chief investment strategist and helps to manage over $400 billion with a B dollars. Jeff, we were talking a bit about secular and cyclical markets, and I know you believe, as do I, that markets move in these long cycles, and within those long cycles are shorter-term trends. Describe that a little bit for us, if you would.
The 1964 to 1982 wide swinging trading range market, where the Dow was basically trapped between 600 and 1,000 for 18 years, it made its nominal price low, the lowest it would get in terms of actual price, in December of 1974. It didn't make its valuation low until August of 1982. That would be the cheapest the Dow would get in terms of price to earnings, price
seven
to
book. Or eight PE back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
With a yield of 7 or 8% too.
The expression I always say is the Dow had 1,000 in 1966, didn't get over 1,000 on a permanent basis till 16 years later, 1982.
That's exactly right. And when the markets broke out decisively above that 1,000, all the old men, and I'm their age now, were telling me I needed to sell all my stocks. And I said, why? And they said, because for 16 years, every time the Dow was anywhere near 1,000, it always went back down, until it didn't in 82, 83. It took professional money managers 3 to 4 years to, in aggregate, re-embrace stocks again. And the retail or individual investor didn't come back in mass until 1987, after the S&P was up 13% in 1 month. And then they got freaked out by the 87 crash. So if you fast forward, we've been through another one of these long 10-plus year trading
2000
ranges.
2000 to 2013.
Yeah.
Where S&P and Dow hit their highs, nominal highs, back in 2000. And then the edge just above it in 07.
October of 07.
Right. And then what?
Well, you came down and you made the equivalent of the December of 74 nominal price low. The equivalent of that was made in March of 2009, and you made the valuation low, in my view, on October 4th of 2011. And here we have again, we've broken out of the top of this long trading range, and people don't trust it. The individual investor don't understand, they think it's all the Federal Reserve and pumping liquidity into the market.
I hear that constantly. That's usually if someone's saying that, I make a guess and say, you don't have a lot of equities, you're wildly underinvested, you've missed most of this move.
That's exactly correct. And what I try to point out to them is that earnings have nearly tripled. If you believe next year's bottom-up operating estimates for the S&P, earnings have nearly tripled. What they don't get is that the equity markets don't care about the absolutes of good or bad. All the equity markets care about is, are things getting better or are things getting worse? And I think things are getting better.
It's hard to argue. We're now, at least in terms of private sector employment, we're now over the level that previously set the high for private sector employment back in the end of 07, beginning of 08. Government hiring has lagged dramatically behind private sector. That's the impact of austerity. But when you look around, it's hard not to say things aren't, it's going slowly, it's gradually, it's not a robust economy, but at least in terms of direction, it's pointing in the right way.
Yeah, and the fact that you've recaptured the jobs that were lost is suggestive that you're going to get a pickup in capital equipment expenditures. If you go on plant tours and talk to the plant managers, they will tell you that they've put off CapEx for so long that the equipment's just plain wearing out. So I think you're going to get a pickup in capital expenditures late this year and into next year, and we think that lifts GDP growth towards 3% in the back half of this year at an annualized run rate, and towards 4% in 2015.
So one of the things we've been talking about with regards to the market over the past 5 years, since the March 09 lows, I've been calling this the most hated bull market in history. How does it compare to the 82 to 87 period, when all the old pros were saying, hey, you're making new highs, this is long overdue to correct?
Well, it's very similar in that people don't believe it. They didn't believe it in 82, 83. They didn't believe it in 2013. They don't believe it in 2014 for the reasons I've already stated. But if you look at the drivers, you can think of this energy boom and some of the trends. My friend Rich Bernstein calls it the American Industrial Renaissance, with manufacturing mm-hmm. coming back here. And if you think of what's going on, I mean, 10 years ago, for every 3 barrels of oil we used, we imported 2. Now we're importing 1, and it's on its way to 0.
Right.
You can think of it as the industrial might of the U.S. with Saudi Arabia layered over the top of it.
Right.
I think things look really good for the next 5 to 10 years.
We've been talking to manufacturers who do a lot of stuff in China, and one of the things they complain about is how inconsistent the electricity is, the power supply. So they're building a variety of electronics to make sure that the amperage and wattage and voltage are steady, that they have to build a battery backup because they never know when there's going to be a brownout. And what they've said about the United States, we run a natural gas line, build our own generator co-located with the factory. It's almost free energy for manufacturing, and we don't have to ship it all the way over from China. It's a huge, huge game changer.
Yeah, and per capita incomes are estimated to go from about $3,100 a year in China this year to $22,400 by 2030. So if they don't have the cheap labor
forever
switch anymore, and they have a lot of natural resources that could be released by fracking, but the problem is they haven't got any water to frack with. There's huge water issues in China. So and the other thing that was learned with the Fukushima thing is how instantly your supply chain, if you're an auto parts place, how quickly your supply chain got cut off.
Right.
So a lot of that stuff is coming back into the U.S. It's not showing up in the empirical manufacturing data quite yet because the plants are still being built.
Right.
But it's coming. I mean, I was out in Austin, Texas. There's a $4 billion Samsung plant going up there. I was in Mobile. 8 months ago, they broke ground in Mobile, Alabama, to build the Airbus 319s and 320s. It's pretty amazing, the projects, if you start looking at them, that are coming back to the U.S.
If you look at the expansion of BMW, Mercedes, Honda, all along that southern auto manufacturing zone, the U.S. has really been written off as a manufacturing powerhouse way too soon.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. When you look at the trends that are in place, the one that really gets me excited, and a lot of people don't believe this, the Canadians do because they live through it, and the British do because they live through it. I think over the next 5 years, we're going to elect smarter policymakers and get smarter policies.
Well, we'll the jury's out on that. But this comes back to the same concept of a long-term secular cycle where you'll go through a period where things are doing mediocre. You have 16, 18 years of the market doing nothing. We went through a period where manufacturing seemed kind of soft, and now it seems that that cycle is turning. Do you get secular cycles not only in equities but in broad economic sectors like manufacturing?
Sure. It's called the business cycle. You studied that in
sure.
business school.
Well, not me, but other people have.
And I just think the trends that are in place here, the energy thing is just profoundly, profoundly bullish. Cheap energy here in the country will cause a lot of manufacturing to come back into the U.S. And the U.S. is still the largest manufacturer in the world. We have an 18.2%
market share?
Yeah, market share, global market share. There's a brain synapse right there.
And, you know, speaking of brains, so we also have biotech and genomics, which is expanding dramatically.
Huge breakthroughs.
When you look at, because people keep, I've heard some of the bears say, well, there's just not another internet. There's not another mobile the way we had it in the 90s. We'll never see that sort of economic growth again. And I look at nanotechnology and 3D printing, and there's so many new technologies. If you look at the startups, the software companies, the fact that King, which makes Candy Crush, can go public at any sort of valuation, that Candy Crush is almost a $1 billion revenue game. A bunch of guys putting together code can generate a product that's that desired by the public. It's really quite fascinating.
Never give up on the creativity of the American people.
That's for sure. So we were talking secular versus cyclical. How would you define just a cyclical market within the broader secular period?
Well, in the trading range market between basically 1964 and 1982, it was about 18 years, you had a dozen cyclical bull and bear markets, but you were still within that big 600 right. to 1,000 range. But you had roughly a dozen 20% or better moves, both up and down, the worst being the 48% decline between January of 1973 and December of 1973.
If you measure that peak to trough, it was over 50%, I believe.
Yes, it was. If you take intradays, yes.
It was a pretty substantial move. And the bounce back, I'm doing this from memory, the bounce back of that was about 74%. Is that about right?
That sounds about right to me.
So that was pretty substantial. I recall the death of equities. That was 79 or so, cover
the magazine
of Business
code,
Week,
yeah.
Right? The death of equities. And had you bought on that death of equities, you might have been a little early, but you did pretty well over the next couple of years.
You did really well over the next 18 years.
Jeff, thank you so much for spending so much time. This has really been a fascinating conversation. I've been speaking with Jeff Sout, Chief Market Strategist for Raymond James, which manages almost $500 billion. If you'd like to hear more of this conversation, you could check out our podcast extras. That's on Bloomberg.com. My daily column appears at BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz or check out my blog at Ritholtz.com. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. This concludes the broadcast portion of our interview. Coming up with our guest, the Radio Podcast Extra. Today, I've been speaking to Jeff Sout of Raymond James. Jeff is the chief investment strategist. The firm runs about $400 billion, and not a penny of that gets deployed without him signing off on it.
I wish that were true.
So we were talking during the break about the March 09 lows, and I think it was March 2nd, you had a pretty bold statement you made right at that time.
I was on Carol Masser's show here at the studio and said the bottoming process that started on October 10th of 2008 when 92.6% of all stocks traded made new annual lows. That's like a 6 or 7 standard deviation
right.
event. That's not supposed to happen. I said the bottoming process started then. It's complete this week. That was on March 2nd, which was a Monday in 2009, and we're all in.
And what was the reaction from clients? By the way, we're both friends with Doug Kass. At the time, around that week, maybe a
Thursday.
Week or so later.
He said it on Thursday.
He called it a generational low. And I had my comments that week also. It was actually on Yahoo Finance. But I love the reaction when you make a statement like that. Generally speaking, it's incredible the pushback you get. What did you experience with clients with that?
I didn't get hate mail, but I got a lot of people that said you're nuts, that you know, they at the inflection points, as I stated earlier, the market is not rational. Mm-hmm. And down in 2009, it wasn't rational. You had, as I said, Citigroup trading at $1. That's not rational. And I've seen those kind of selling climaxes before, as have you.
Capitulations.
Yeah.
We had one in 02, 03.
You had it in 1987, where the Dow lost 22%.
Right.
In one day. That's a selling climax, and it's kind of like, what was her name, Lillian Carter, talking about pornography. You'll know it when you see
right.
it.
Know it when you recognize it.
And if you've been around this business long enough, you can recognize a selling climax.
I've long said a bottom is much easier to spot than a top. A top is a long, gradual process, and you have to observe people falling out of love with stock, whereas the bottom is just... Capitulation
yep.
technically means surrender. And you see when people are just puking up stock, there's no way to avoid that. And if we go back to that March 09, you recall some of the wise old men were calling for Dow 5,000 and Dow 3,500. I even heard a Dow 1,000 call. And to me, that just sounds like, wait, markets have been cut in half. How often, at least in the modern era, when a major market gets cut in half, how often is that a bad buying entry?
It's a bad bet. It's just like all these deflationists that have been running around for the past 10 years saying that, you know, the U.S. economy is going into a deflationary vortex. It could happen. It happened in the 30s, but historically it is a bad bet. And the same thing is true when a stock market gets cut in half. You know, betting that it's going to get cut in half again is just not a good bet.
Right. Statistically, that's a low probability. Emotionally, it feels good to say, all right, I'm giving in to this. But when is the difficult trade ever satisfactory emotionally? It's always the easier trade is to just go with the flow.
Yeah, the problem with a lot of investors is they don't manage the risk. In the book, The Intelligent Investor, the central theme is captured in Benjamin Graham's statement where he said, "The essence of portfolio management is the management of risks, not the management of returns. I'm actually more proud of the sell calls I have made than the bottom call in 09. There was a Dow Theory sell signal in September of 1999. Raymond James, to my knowledge, is the only investment bank that wrote about it. There was a Dow Theory buy signal in June of 03. There was a Dow Theory sell signal on November 23rd of 07 that nobody wanted to hear about because the Dow had just made a new all-time
92% from the 03 lows, absolutely.
Yeah. And just made a new all-time high the previous month.
So since we're talking about Dow Theory, which says we want to see the transports, which move these goods around the country, make a new high the same time we see the Dow Industrials make a new high, if you look at the markets, transports have been doing pretty well lately.
You've had over a dozen Dow Theory buy signals since June of 2009. Now, just the other week, just a week and a half ago, you got a Dow Theory, not a sell signal, but you got a Dow Theory upside non-confirmation when the transportation average made new all-time forever highs and the Dow Jones failed to do that.
Right.
And now we're getting the result of that, along with some other things. You saw the NASDAQ on Friday fall below its 100-day moving average, which it hasn't done in over a year. It's always bounced off that.
So we're recording this in April of 2014. Markets are within 5% of all-time highs. Do you find it amusing that you just set an all-time high, certainly on the S&P and the Dow? The NASDAQ hasn't breached its 2000 highs, but we're at 14-year highs. The market gives up 3, 4%, and people start screaming like it's the end of the universe. I've never heard so many told-you-sos from people who have missed a 50 or 100% move up on a 3% move off the highs.
Yeah, well, it's the Peter Schiff syndrome. I mean, you know, he's bearish all the way up for the past 5 years. My friend John Malden, and I like John a lot. He's a great writer. He's a very smart guy. But, you know, these people just, they're looking at the deflationary argument, and it freezes you. It freezes you from buying stocks.
The tail has wagged the dog a little bit with some of these people. I could tell you from personal experience, the thing that made me change the way I look at flipping bullish and bearish is when I finally succumbed to people who have been offering me money to manage for years, when they say, here, take this, when we finally started taking assets to manage, and we've been doing it now for about 5 years, it becomes really difficult to say, okay, we're going to step into cash and we're going to stay bearish for this long. Because when you think about the math of asset management, you could recover from a pullback pretty easily in markets. But if you miss a 50 or 100% move, there's no coming back from that. You've done permanent damage. And unless you can magically tack on 20 years to these folks investing before retirement, and you can't, you've created a hole that you can't dig out of.
No, that's exactly right.
It really focuses you on, it's better to buy more on a dip than to avoid the drop and then try and jump back in. And I can't tell you how many people have said to us, hey, you know, everybody said I was crazy when I got out in January 08, and I missed the whole downdraft. But when people like Doug Cass and Jeff Sout were saying, okay, you could go back in March 09, I thought they were crazy. And here it is, fill in the blank, 100, 150, almost 200% higher, and I'm still sitting in cash. It's a real challenge to overcome.
Well, there's a money manager out on the West Coast that developed a system, and it's not real complex. For every 1%, if he's sitting in too much cash, for every 1% the S&P goes up, he puts 3% of cash back to work. It's
so
kind
that's
of a forced.
That's just his model. You know, you could also just say, my friend Meb Faber, also out in L.A., when he's not surfing, he's a quant, and his rule of thumb is, look, if you take the 10-month moving average, which is less noisy than the 200-day, but effectively the same thing, when stocks, if you're out of the market and stocks move above their 10-month moving average, you have to be long. You can't. So that would mean the market's trending higher. It's been trending higher for a while. Both the short and long-term moving averages have an upward bias. You can't be out of the markets when we're over the 10-month. And it's not a perfect timing tool, but it's better than, and had you followed that in 08, 09, you wouldn't have bottom ticked it, but you would have gotten back into equities when the Dow crossed 8,500. So you missed 2,000 points, but here we are at 16,000 and change. You caught all of that. So each 1% puts 3% cash back. You could use a 10-month moving average. But what you're really saying is the key is to have a methodology that doesn't rely on your gut, but some objective metric that forces you to put money to work rather than waiting till it feels good.
Yeah, the other thing that I would tell listeners is that the most important thing is to manage the risk. If you manage the risk and raise cash like you did in January of 08, even though we lost, I was down 8.5% in 08, but I had cash. I had 40%
down 8.5%, let me point out, in a year that was down 38%.
That's about
so
right.
So you were 3,000 basis points better than the overall market. Down 8.5% is not a bad year.
Yeah, but if you
during a crash,
if you had a index fund, an S&P index fund in October of 07 and didn't manage the risk, by March of 09, you were down 58.5%.
That's right. That was peak to trough.
And that's when you get the emotions. That's when you get the selling climax. I'm out. I'm never buying stocks
right.
again.
I can't believe I watched half my money disappear. I got to do, you know, the old joke, and retail brokers tell this all the time, I don't care what you do, just make the pain stop. Well, this is really the wrong place to sell. Yeah, but didn't you tell me that 5,000 points higher? I'm done listening to you. Just get me out. And that's how you get a bottom.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So we've talked a bit about secular cycles. We've talked about the shorter term cyclical things. What do you think people don't understand most about investing? If there's one thing you could beat into every investor, what would it be?
It would be to manage the risk, because if you manage the risk, you take a lot of emotion out of your investment decisions.
So that's risk to the downside as well as to the upside.
More
whatever
risk
your position is, you have to manage risk.
Yes.
For it. So cash is not a risk-free position. The risk with cash is the market leaves and you're not on the train.
Yeah, I am never 100% invested. I never use margin. The most I'm ever invested is 95%, because my dad drilled into my head that cash is indeed an asset class, because to assume that the investment opportunity sets that are available to you today are as good or better than any that will present themselves next week, next month, next quarter is naive. Mm-hmm. And you need to have cash to take advantage of that. I do not want to be in a position where I have to sell some Raymond James stock to raise cash to buy a good idea that I've heard here. And I have no problem of raising 40 to 50 to 60% cash. I'm never totally out of stocks. Never. Even if I think it's going down, I'll hedge. Like in 07, we hedged Raymond James stock and the stock fell from 36 to 10. We didn't lose any money. There's ways to do that. And you know exactly what I'm talking
about.
So
you could do it with call options. You could do it with put options. There's a variety of different ways to buy a little bit of insurance. How active are you in terms of trading? For long-time investors, are you a sit-on-your-hands type of guy, or are you a little more involved?
I think last year I only put on only about a half a dozen trades during the course of the year, but because the whole market was going up. And one of the things that again, a lot of people don't understand, because we've been in a range-bound market for 13 years, is that in a secular bull market, one of the best things you can do is just sit.
Right.
And hang on and watch things, because as you know, Barry, stocks always go a lot higher than anybody thinks they can. Just like in a bear market, they go a lot lower than anybody thinks they can.
That's exactly right. In terms of thinking about the next couple of years, can this be year five of a 18-year bull market? Is that within the range of possibilities?
I think it is. I absolutely think it is. I think that the trends in energy independence and the American industrial renaissance coming back here, I think is so powerful and so bullish that this market's going to go a lot higher and surprise a lot of people.
What about the valuation concerns? I keep hearing people tell me stocks are expensive. You look at the 10-year CAPE. Earnings, we haven't talked about earnings mean reversion. You've written about that. Mm-hmm. How many people have been saying Earnings are at a cyclical high. They're at an all-time high relative to GDP. Therefore, it has to come back to earth. How do you respond to those folks?
I would make the argument that they're looking at a horizontal mean reversion line. Profits or earnings get too high, they revert back to the horizontal line. The business cycle being what it is, they go below the horizontal business mean reversion line, then they come back above it. You've seen that over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I make the argument somewhere in the 90s because more and more earnings are coming from abroad.
Right.
And
it's now half of the S&P 500, just about.
And there's something that the Federal Reserve wrote a research report or white paper about 3 years ago that said companies in the U.S. accumulate $1.5 trillion a year of intangible capital and our accounting system doesn't measure it. Apple spent a lot of money developing and perfecting iTunes. They can write off the research and development costs, but now they have iTunes with 600 million embedded users. What's it worth?
And 600 million credit cards. Well, as soon as that becomes the mobile way to pay for everything on your phone, how do you put a value on that?
It's worth a lot, and Apple can't carry it on its balance sheet as an asset. So between those two metrics, I make the argument that your horizontal mean reversion line started having an upward tilt to it sometime in the mid-1990s.
So this isn't going to revert back to zero. This is going to revert back to
an upward
sloping, rising trend line.
So instead of getting a reversion to the mean of 40 or 50%, you get a reversion to the upward sloping line of 5 or 10%.
You know, you said something related to this about extraordinary high margins. We talk about affiliates and how companies, in an accounting basis, account the revenue and margins coming in. It shows up as pure profit, not revenue. Explain that a little bit.
That's exactly right, and that gets to be pretty technical on trying to explain that to people. I would argue this. If the earnings estimates are anywhere near the mark of $137 to $138 next year, we're trading at about 13.6 times next year's
earnings. Not terribly expensive.
Not terribly. It's given the median is about 16, 16.2.
Right. If you look at the forward earnings in the beginning of the year versus the way we try to smooth out the business cycle is we looked at this based on the 15-year median P.E. multiple. We were elevated, but we were only a little bit elevated. And in fact, Merrill Lynch looked at 15 separate metrics of valuation. The 10-year CAPE from Bob Shiller was the most expensive. It was at 22 or 23.
It's about 25 now.
All right. And over 27, 28 in the past has been a problem. But everything else showed us as fairly valued to, you know, maybe a little above average, but not nothing like 99, 2000. People have been talking about, you know, when the forward PE multiple of the S&P 500 is 32, that's insanely expensive. But we're not even close. We're half that today.
Yeah, I would make the argument that the CAPE, the cyclic adjusted PE ratio, while it does have a good track record, that you had big aberrations in earnings in 07, 08, 09. And since it uses a backward look on those earnings and tries to smooth it out, I don't think it's a valid measure on this particular cycle. So I just use the simple forward earnings, bottom up.
Right.
And we're trading at about 15.5, 15.6 this year's estimate and about 13.6, 13.7 next year's. And I can't find a structured account in Europe that even has a 20% weighting in U.S. equities when the MSCI World, their benchmark that they compare to, is 43 or 44%.
So in other words, lots of people are wildly underinvested in U.S. equities. But by the way, we did a study on Shiller's CAPE. And we crunched some numbers and found, I want to say it was either 97 or 98. Since 1998, the CAPE was on the overvalued side 93% of the time.
Wow.
And it tends to lag. Now, whether that's the change in rates over, we just finished a 30-year bull market in bonds, and rates have gone from a bajillion down to zero or practically zero. So that might be impacting it. There are a lot of variables and one-offs that people have been using as an excuse. But the bottom line is we had the crisis, we had the crash, we had the capitulation, and earnings seem to have recovered nicely. The economy is still growing. People are finding jobs. We went from 10%+ unemployment to 6 and change. And if we weren't firing teachers and cops and firemen and government workers at the rate we have been, we'd be below 6% unemployment. This is not, granted, it's not a robust 1990s recovery, but it's hard to look at things and not say we're moving in the right direction.
And as I said earlier, the markets don't care about the absolutes of good or bad. All the markets care about is, are things getting better or are things getting worse?
So let's look around the world. You mentioned overseas. So clearly the U.S. is once again the locomotive pulling the global economy. What do you see in Europe? What do you think? Because I know you travel extensively.
I do.
What does Europe look like to you?
Europe looks to me like it has reduced headwinds, and I don't think you can make a strategic and say, I'm just going to buy Europe. But I think there are companies in Europe that are cheap, that have very good business models. I mean, Nestle is headquartered in a place called Vevey, Switzerland, right next to Montreux, where the jazz festival is at the top of Lake Geneva. Only 2% of their revenues come from Switzerland. So is it a Swiss company, or is it a global company that happens to be based in Vevey, Switzerland? So I think you know, names like that, names like Siemens, the old Asa Brown, Bavera, ABB, companies like that have very
big engineering strong, company,
yeah,
ABB,
very strong franchises. So I think you should have some exposure there on a stock specific basis. I think you should have some exposure to emerging and frontier markets.
Hold off on emerging. We're going to get to that in a sec. So what about the concept, and we read this a month or two ago, Crimea, Ukraine, Russia, oh my God, this is going to be horrible for Europe, and this is going to be terrible for American markets, and we're all going to die. What about that sort of nonsense?
Well, they've invaded Crimea, and I guess there have been a couple of people shot, but the world still seems to be hanging together. I did see on the broad tape this morning that another city, and I can't remember the name of it, actually petitioned to break off from the Kiev government and have Russia come in to stabilize things. So it's a thing in motion over there, and I don't quite know how it's going to play out, but I don't think it's going to lead to World War III, and I don't think it's going to be all that impactful on world markets. On Russia, but
so far it's had almost no impact, despite, you know, the general hand-wringing and people running around. So with Russia, as an aside, let's talk a little bit about the rest of the BRIC countries, China, India, Brazil. What do you see in South America? What do you see in Asia?
Brazil has issues right now. It's a valid point. You know, there are emerging markets and there are emerging markets.
Right.
One of the real revelations to me in the past 4 years is when Cheryl and I went to Warsaw, and they asked me to fly in on a Thursday night, and I was to speak to 26 pension fund managers over lunch the next day, and then they wanted me to hang out until Monday and see some of the other accounts were doing. And I was kind of apprehensive about spending 4 days in Poland. I've been back 4 times since, and it's a phenomenal country. It's booming. It's the only country in Europe that didn't go into a recession. Somebody made some very good decisions in Poland, you know, 20 years ago. Mexico has finally gotten new policymakers in place, and they're getting new policies, and that country's getting, you know, positive current account accounts, and so there's issues like that. But I do think you should have some exposure to emerging and frontier markets. You might be 6 months to 12 months early. So I have told people to pick a good mutual fund. I happen to own mutual funds where I talk to and know the portfolio managers. And if you had $100,000 appetite for emerging and frontier markets, break that $100,000 into four $25,000 tranches. Buy the first tranche today, wait 2 or 3 months, buy the second tranche, wait 2 or 3 months, buy the third tranche, wait 2 or 3 months, and buy the fourth tranche.
Rules-based investing, not emotional-based investing. Anything else in Asia when we look around and see things along the lines in Vietnam, Korea? Anything else on the Pacific Rim? What about Japan?
If I was young like you, I'd take the little bit of money I have.
Meaning 50-something? Is that that?
That's
that
young to me.
Okay.
And I would go to Vietnam. What's going on in Vietnam is pretty amazing. I mean, Intel's got a billion-dollar fab plant there.
There's a number of big plants being built.
Yeah, the food is terrific.
Thank the French for that.
The best beaches in the world. You don't have to worry about water. Everything grows over there. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, and I don't understand this, the Vietnamese people love Americans.
You're not the first person who have said that. That whole invading war thing back in the 60s.
Maybe they all died off.
Very much so. You know, the other country before this most recent set of elections, I heard a lot of Chinese manufacturing was moving to Vietnam, and to Turkey is another country that people have talked about, although they seem to have taken a turn for the worst with cutting Twitter out, and now that these elections are just about done, maybe they can get back to business. So you like Poland, you like Mexico, you like Vietnam. Any other? And by the way, you could pretty much pick up an iShare for just about any country in the world these days. You could pick up an ETF, if you want to, and not pick specific stocks, or if you don't know any specific any particular mutual funds you want to mention.
The one I own for international is run by a friend of mine, and it's the MFS International Diversification Fund. It's run by Thomas Melendez, who mm-hmm. has boots on the ground, and I've known him, 15 years, and the symbol is MDIDX.
And that's individual companies in emerging market and frontier
and
markets.
Developed. He can go to 25% in emerging and frontier markets, and the rest of it is international.
Mm-hmm. So, to review, we've covered cyclical and secular markets. We've covered buying stampedes. We've covered the U.S. and Europe and emerging markets. We've talked about Dow theory. We talked about who were your mentors and how you went from E.F. Hutton, and I'm old enough to remember when E.F. Hutton speaks commercials, all the way to Raymond James. We've been there for 15, well over a decade,
15
right?
15 years, yeah.
Yep. So is there anything we left out? What else is worth talking about?
I think if somebody came into me with $1 million right now, I would put $250,000 of it into select mutual funds, again, where I know the portfolio manager, mm-hmm. because I, like you, have more of a value vent than I have a tough time paying, 50
paying
times revenues for
right.
something. But I know people like Tom O'Halloran across the river over here at Lord Abbott. Now, mm-hmm. I own his fund. He's one of the best growth stock investors. Or Mary Lasante, who is from the old E.F. Hutton days, who runs mm-hmm. the old Adams Harkness Small Cap Growth Fund. Who was up?
Sure. I remember them.
54% she was up last year.
Wow, that's amazing.
They buy the kind of stocks that I'm afraid to buy.
Right.
So I've got about a dozen portfolio managers whose funds I actually own, and I would position that with 250, and then I would buy some individual stocks to try and add alpha
right.
on top of those. I would be very careful of my fixed income allocation because the secular bull market in fixed income, in my view, ended in July of 2012. Mm-hmm. There are mutual funds and bond funds that are geared for higher interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Chris Towle across the river here over in Jersey City at Lord Abbott runs the Lord Abbott Bond Debenture Fund.
Mm-hmm.
He was up about 7.5% last year.
It's a good year for bonds.
And the other one I own is run by a gentleman named Bill Coley. It's the Putnam Diversified Income Trust, PDINX.
Mm-hmm.
And he was up about 7.25% last year. I would be very careful with fixed income because I've been in the business long enough to remember when the 30-year treasury was 2% on its way to 15%, and you lost a lot of money in fixed income.
To say the least. Last question I want to go over with. I'll let you wax philosophical here. So you've been working on the street for over 40 years. The business has certainly changed over that time. What do you see as the significant changes for the worse, and what do you see that's changed for the better?
Wow, I think one.
That's a loaded question.
No, I
right?
shouldn't say this at Bloomberg, but I think actually Bloomberg does a really good job. It's information overload.
Right.
I have to screen things out. It's there's too much information coming at you. If you all the time, you know, look for all this information, you avoid thinking.
Right.
And thinking about things. And you're a really good thinker and a really good writer. And it's easy to
But that's you're absolutely right about, you know, last week I was speaking with Michael Mobison, and one of the things we were talking about was the self-confidence bias, the optimism bias that investors run into. And the paradox is when you have just a little bit of information, you'd be surprised that that's sufficient to make an intelligent investment decision. And then all the information you get on top of that does nothing for your decision-making process, but paradoxically, it makes you overconfident and more likely to either make a bad decision or stick with a bad decision and not admit, you know, then you have the endowment effect where since you put all this time and energy researching it, you're less likely to jettison it. And so this massive amount of data that's available at your fingertips, that doesn't really help you, this information overload.
Yeah, my dad put it real succinctly. He said, son, if you're going to be wrong quickly for a de minimis loss of capital.
I started as a trader in this business, and the expression was, it's okay to be wrong, it's not okay to stay wrong. And that's just another way of saying the same thing. So that's the negative. Too much information, too much noise, a cacophony of commentary and data and websites and blogs and everything else. What do you see that you like? What's the positive these days?
Well, I think the spreads have gotten much narrower, and that's a very good thing for the individual investor. There's a lot of hullabaloo right now about rigged markets because of high-frequency trading. Well, you know, I would tell you that no high-frequency trader is going to front-run a 300 or 400-share order from
right.
Joe Smith.
Right.
And that if you want to totally avoid high-frequency traders, that you use limit orders.
Right.
I mean, there are ways to go around, but I think the speed of trading has narrowed spreads. I mean, it used to be you'd go into an over-the-counter trading house and the market might be, you know, 20 bid, 20 and three quarters offered,
right.
And there'd be
right.
three quarters of a point spread. And now you go in and it's 20 bid, you know, 20.02 cents offered. So it's the compression of spreads has been very beneficial to the individual investor. I also think that investors have gotten a lot smarter in terms of using things like Bloomberg, like Yahoo Finance, to at least do a little homework and
right.
and find out that a company's not trading at, you know, 100 times silly.
Right.
I think they do their homework more. I do think that they do need a good financial advisor. The 1970s was the decade of the product. My generation got out of school and bought the first house and the first car.
Mm-hmm.
The 1980s was the decade of the image. We bought the Rolex watches, the big house, and the Lockgate community and the golf course. 1990s were experiential. We went abroad and brought back experiences, not things. The new millennium is the age of the relationship. My boat mechanic called me when I was walking over here and said, Jeff, your generator's broken on your boat. And I said, Johnny, just fix it. I don't need the best price,
right.
but I would like it fixed and fixed right. And my generation is looking for that with a boat mechanic, a doctor, a lawyer, but especially a financial advisor.
I can't disagree with you at all on any of those things. And our personal experience has been, how do you justify your 1%? Well, we justify it by giving you not only asset management but financial planning and preventing you from shooting yourself in the foot. The public today has enough information that they could really hurt themselves if they're not careful, especially if they allow their emotions to get in the way.
Correct.
Jeff, this has been great. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us.
It's my pleasure, my friend.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.